with 19 cases, even in response to BA2. The vaccines are actually working remarkably well, given the challenges of evolution, he said. He agrees, adding in his email that the results emphasize the importance of booster doses. Focusing on the primary vaccination schedule isn't enough anymore. There have to be plans to effectively get populations vaccinated through a booster, he wrote. But going forwards, Aburat thinks researchers should move away from designing vaccines against single variants and instead focus on pan-coronavirus vaccines. He says this would be a more fundamental solution for the future.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Spokesman for Yemen's armed forces, Brigadier General Yahya Sari', says Sana'a has staged a fresh retaliatory operation against the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in a bid to break the all-out blockade Riyadh has imposed on its southern neighbor. Yahya Sari' noted that targets in Saudi Arabia's port city of Jeddah, as well as Jizan, have been struck in the third phase of special operations. Earlier, Sari' announced the second phase, saying Yemeni forces had conducted major operations, which he described as special in nature, and that the mission had been carried out successfully. He pointed out the large-scale operation has been staged with a batch of ballistic missiles and drones. According to the spokesman, Phase 2 involved projectiles flying across the border, targeting a number of vital and sensitive sites in the regions of Abha, Khamis Umshayyad, Jizan, and Samata, as well as southern Tehran, with facilities belonging to Saudi oil giant Aramco among the sites targeted. Saudi state media acknowledged a barrage of drone and missile attacks. Despite the kingdom claiming to have intercepted the projectiles, it later reported that drones had hit a petroleum distribution terminal, a natural gas plant, and an oil refinery that led to a temporary reduction in the refinery's production levels. On March 11, Sari' announced the first phase of this operation, which also included the bombing of a number of vital and sensitive Saudi facilities affiliated with Aramco in Riyadh, among other areas. He has stressed that the operations come within the framework of Yemen's legitimate right to respond to what he labeled as an unjust siege. According to UN experts, the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen is having a catastrophic effect on millions of people.
The Yemenis have suffered a lot because they cannot import even food or medicine. And the past 70 years have been hell to the Yemenis. And it is now seven painful years for them, and the world is just watching.
Sari' has pledged that the Yemeni armed forces will carry out more military operations in the not-so-distant future to break the siege, warning Riyadh the upcoming retaliatory attacks will include sensitive targets that are beyond the imagination of the Saudis. The Saudi war on Yemen is on the brink of its seventh anniversary. On March 26, 2015, Riyadh and a number of its regional allies, backed by the United States, declared war on Yemen. Riyadh said the offensive would take a couple of weeks to achieve its goals, one of which was to restore the former government in Sana'a, whose term had expired but was loyal to the Saudis. However, 7 years later, analysts say the kingdom and its allies, including Washington, have underestimated the determination and the steadfastness of the Yemeni forces and nation to seek sovereignty from Saudi rule. In normal warfare, Saudi Arabia would have the upper hand in this war. Riyadh enjoys unwavering support from the West, in particular the United States. Washington has provided logistical and intelligence backing to the Saudi Air Force, while the UK has trained Saudi pilots, but the real support has come in the form of arms sales. America and its Western allies have sold the Saudis advanced weapons to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, making a massive profit. Despite warnings by rights groups of Western complicity in war crimes amid an indiscriminate Saudi bombardment campaign that has killed women and children, Western weapons continue to flow into the kingdom. Despite all this support, the question is, after 7 years, why can't Saudi Arabia win its war on Yemen?
They do not have legitimate goals by waging the war. Number two, their people, their soldiers have become demoralized because of their inability to score victories over the Yemenis. And thirdly, the Yemenis are known historically for their power.
Under a tight blockade, Yemeni forces have manufactured their own indigenous ballistic missiles and drones. Despite their relatively low costs in comparison with Saudi weapons, they have proven very effective. Yemeni officials say they have no choice but to expand retaliatory operations against targets deep inside Saudi Arabia, with the goal of forcing Riyadh to end its blockade and to end its air raids.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has visited the United Arab Emirates in his first such visit to an Arab state since the beginning of foreign-backed violence in Syria in 2011. Meeting with Assad on Friday, Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan stressed that Syria is a fundamental pillar of Arab security. The Emirati official added that his country is keen to strengthen cooperation with Syria, describing the two nations as brotherly peoples. Assad, for his part, urged that in order to protect the regional countries must continue with adherence to their principles, the sovereignty of their countries, and the interests of their peoples. Assad's visit to the UAE took place only months after the Emirates' foreign minister, Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, traveled to the Syrian capital, Damascus. It also came amid the widely reported prospect of Damascus' return to the Arab League regional bloc.
So they are, along with the Saudi Arabia, they are rethinking their alliances with the United States, especially, and putting all of their eggs in the United States basket. They are thinking of, let's say, diversifying their alliances along other lines and looking towards China and Russia and other nations.
The recent thaw in relations comes despite the fact that almost all of the region's Arab states turned their backs on Syria in 2014 when Damascus came to face a huge wave of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. Some of the Arab regimes even began lending financial and logistical support to the anti-Syria elements. Observers say the meeting serves to underline the regional Arab states' interest in resuming their normal relations with Syria, that together with its allies has done much in the way of emerging from the ruins of more than a decade of foreign-backed militancy and terrorism. It's worth noting that the United Arab Emirates used to be among the Arab regimes that backed foreign-sponsored militants operating to topple the Assad government. Experts, however, attribute such signs of rapprochement between Syria and its fellow Arab nations in the region to the Syrian government's ability to recapture vast swaths of its territory and turn the tide against the foreign-sponsored militants and terrorists. The Emirati foreign minister said during his visit to Damascus in November that his country supports efforts to reestablish stability in Syria, adding that what happened in the Syrian nation affected all other Arab countries too. He went so far as to say that Syria, under the leadership of President al-Assad and the efforts of its people, is able to overcome the challenges imposed by the war, noting that his country is always ready to offer assistance to the Syrian people. Yet, the U.S. opposition to warmer relations between its Arab allies and Syria on the one hand, and the UAE's move to normalize ties with Israel on the other, are raising questions about whether a rapprochement is possible between Damascus and Abu Dhabi.
They have seen that that the United States has and its allies have seized, for example, almost $2 billion in Venezuelan gold and then $9 billion in Afghan dollars held in Western banks. And now we're talking about several hundreds of billions of Russian money in Western banks, which is also being withheld from Russia. They're basically stealing it. So the UAE and Saudi Arabia are both rethinking whether they want to put all of their oil money into dollars which are held in Western banks, or whether they need to create new alliances.
The visit by top Syrian Emirati officials are a clear sign that 11 years of foreign-backed militancy in Syria have failed to achieve the desired result, and that those behind the conflict are beginning to realize that. In recent weeks, the United States has deployed several thousand American troops to Eastern Europe for what it calls helping the security in the region. But how can that help the security when it was part of the main problem why Russia attacked Ukraine in the first place? Moscow has become increasingly wary of NATO's expansion toward its borders and describes it as its red line. One can conclude that more American troops in the region can't help achieving peace there at all. Several U.S. and NATO officials have also noted that they are not looking for a direct conflict with Russia, rejecting Ukraine's calls for establishing a no-fly zone over the country and an offer from Poland to give its entire fleet of warplanes to Kiev. So, if there won't be a war with Russia, what objectives are the U.S. and NATO troops in East Europe accomplishing?
Well, for as secretive as the Pentagon is being with this new wave of deployments, the true goal behind them is fairly obvious. Russia has defied NATO hegemony in Ukraine and has proven that they are capable of both militarily and politically rejecting and defending themselves against NATO aggression. So what the Pentagon wants to do with this new wave of deployments is essentially twofold. They want to simultaneously assert NATO's dominance in the near Russia regions, like the Baltic states and the rest of Eastern Europe and Central Asia. And they also want to prepare, or at least posture for the preparing of, further military aid to support either directly or through further NATO deployments.
Even if the troops are there to conduct military drills, which will, by the way, draw the ire of Russia, there should have been a lot more footage and photos of the troops there, as it's usually the norm. But data about what the U.S. troops are doing there has been curiously scarce. The number of American soldiers in Europe has increased by several thousands in the last several weeks. That's according to NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg. Speaking alongside the German Minister of Foreign Affairs, the NATO chief said the 30-member military alliance has increased its deterrence and defense, especially in the east, with hundreds of thousands of troops on, quote, heightened alert there. According to Stoltenberg, 60,000 troops are under direct NATO command.
But we face a new reality for our security. So we must reset our collective defense and deterrence for the longer term. Today, we tasked our military commanders to develop options across all domains: land, air, sea, cyber, and space. On land, our new posture should include substantially more forces in the eastern part of the alliance, at higher readiness, with more pre-positioned equipment and supplies.
U.S. President Joe Biden's policy on NATO is a departure from that of the former Trump administration. Back in 2020, Donald Trump planned to withdraw 12,000 U.S. troops from Germany over a spiraling feud with the NATO ally that he accused of taking advantage of the United States on trade. The former president was also critical of European nations for failing to meet NATO's defense budget. But Biden stopped the measure before it even started. The conflict in Ukraine has given the U.S. another excuse to expand its military presence in Europe. Increasing the number of troops overseas means more military costs, which in the event of a war with Russia would be even higher. Can the U.S. and its NATO allies afford the costs and the risks?
Prior to the special military operation in Ukraine, much of the Western media and the Pentagon itself had essentially doubted Russia's military capabilities of defying NATO hegemony, and they were looking to expand NATO influence into Eastern Europe and Central Asia. So they did not view Russia as a threat prior to the special military operation and the essential evisceration of the Ukrainian military during the process of it. So Russia has proven that they can and will oppose NATO hegemony and will defend themselves against NATO aggression.
So far, the West's response to the conflict in Ukraine has been imposing a slew of sanctions on Russia. Whether that can get them what they want, or it turns out to be shooting themselves in the foot amid a deepening energy crisis, is anybody's guess at this point.
The fate of many months of intense negotiations in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the 2015 Iran deal hangs in the balance. The dialogue seems to face a make-or-break moment in the coming days. A draft text of an agreement between Iran and the P4+1 group, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany, is almost complete. The diplomatic effort seems to be near a climax, but still the very few remaining gaps in the text are keeping the whole thing in limbo. This week, Iran's top diplomat Hossein Amir Abdullahian said the parties are closer than ever to a final agreement.
The Iranian government has made it very clear that the red lines that have to be respected and not crossed include a respect for Iran's missile program, which is well within its sovereign rights, a lifting of the brutal economic sanctions that have been placed on the Iranian nation and the Iranian people, and likewise for the guarantee that the United States would not remove itself and break the deal once again.
Hossein Amir Abdullahian said that Tehran is ready for a final deal if its red lines are observed. He said a good and lasting deal can definitely emerge in Vienna if the United States acts realistically and refrains from making new and wrong demands. He made the remarks soon after a trip to Moscow, where he sat down with his counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The meeting came amid speculations that Russia's demands for written guarantees from the U.S. to ensure that Tehran-Moscow trade ties will not be affected by Western sanctions over Ukraine have complicated the Vienna talks. But the Iranian and Russian top diplomats made it clear that that is not the case. During a joint press conference with his Iranian counterpart in Moscow, Lavrov ended speculations about Russian demands regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. The Russian foreign minister made it clear that Moscow has received written guarantees from Washington that Western sanctions will not prevent cooperation within the framework of the Iran deal. He noted that no illegal sanctions can stop the growth of Iran-Russia ties. The top Russian diplomat stressed that Moscow wants a quick revival of the JCPOA, and the Americans must return to the agreement and lift their illegal sanctions. The ball now seems to be in America's court if it is serious about reviving the JCPOA. Negotiators in Vienna have been trying to find a way to remove American unilateral sanctions against Iran and allow the U.S. to return to the 2015 deal. The U.S. sanctions were imposed after U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018. U.S. President Joe Biden has acknowledged that his predecessor's pullout was wrong. But Biden's words have done little to solve America's credibility problem.
So one of the things that we have to be very concerned about is that the U.S. Unwillingness to agree that they will never leave the deal and resume coercive sanctions means that it is very likely that if another U.S. administration is elected, especially a Republican one that is more hawkish on foreign policy, and more closely aligned with Israel, that they will leave the deal and reimpose sanctions on Iran. And one must be made very well aware of the fact that the Zionist lobby in the United States is extremely powerful.
Observers believe that the United States, as the party that abandoned the deal and threw the JCPOA in tatters, is expected to do more now that the negotiations have reached this critical stage. The coming days will probably show whether Washington will take the necessary political decisions.
Hello.
Congratulate all Iranians and Persian-speaking peoples of the world on the occasion of Nowruz.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the televised speech delivered on March 1st, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Mab'ath. Ignorance has been criticized in the Quran. What is this ignorance like? This form of ignorance does not only mean illiteracy and stupidity. Of course, illiteracy is a part of it, but it has a broader meaning. Mean conducts and temperaments are part of it as well, some of which I referred to earlier. The people there used to behave in a brutish manner, such as killing, stealing, raping, violating others' rights, and trampling on the weak. All of these were common among the people of the Arabian Peninsula. These are the constituents of Jahiliyyah. Sexual obscenity and chaos, moral decadence, and the disappearance of modesty in people's lives, these things were there and constituted the elements of Jahiliyyah. Ba'tha confronted all these negative attributes. These kind of Jahiliyyah that is mentioned in Surah Al-Ahzab, the verse is addressed to the Holy Prophet's wives and make not a dazzling display like that of the former times of ignorance was like this. It encompasses illiteracy, folly, stupidity, bad-temperedness, oppression, discrimination, violation of others' rights, the trampling of the weak, sexual obscenity, and decadence and moral chaos. All these were part of Jahiliyyah.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, the Holy Prophet fought against Jahiliyyah. The important point is that many of the moral vices that were common in Mecca and the Arabian Peninsula and which the Holy Prophet combated exist in the so-called Western civilization of the present time in a more organized and serious way and in much broader scopes. The same moral vices exist in broader scopes and with increasing intensity. Well, today life in the Western civilization is based on greed and avarice. The basis of life in Western civilization is greed and avarice. Today, the basis of all Western values is money. Everything is measured with money. The foundation of all Western values rests on money at present. Morality, spirituality, and everything else is measured with money. The common policy among governments moves in the direction of discrimination and the fettering of companies and cartels. This is how things are today.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. Guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
In the limelight.
Many of Blair's enemies believe that he lied, says Chris Mullen, writer, in an article published under the heading, Tony Blair can never escape his role in the Iraq disaster. Stay tuned for more. Blair, the former British Prime Minister, who more than anyone else was responsible for persuading the British Parliament and a majority of the public that British troops should take part in the invasion of Iraq, remains in denial. Almost alone, he insists to this day that it was the right decision, but one has only to look into his eyes whenever he is challenged on the subject to see that he is haunted by it. Iraq never goes away. 20 years on, the subject is back in the headlines following a decision by the Queen to make Blair a Knight of the Garter, one of the UK's highest honors awarded solely at the discretion of the monarch. Ordinarily, such an award to a former prime minister, particularly one who held office for a decade, would be uncontroversial. Sooner or later, most former prime ministers are also so honored, and no one raises an eyebrow. This time, however, it is different. No sooner had the announcement been made than Blair's many enemies launched an online petition requesting that the Queen reconsider. Overwhelmingly, the signatories are likely to be those who oppose the war from the outset, many of whom regard Blair as the devil incarnate. But the right-wing media, who at the time were by and large in favor of the war, are also stirring the pot. In particular, they have alighted upon a recent memoir by Blair's former defense secretary, Geoff Hoon, who alleges that he was ordered by an official in Blair's office to burn a memorandum from the Attorney General, which implied that without a specific UN endorsement, the war was illegal. The official concerned, who incidentally is the very one quoted by film producer Friend, denies ever having given such an order. All the same, Hoon's allegation has a plausible ring to it. Everyone knows that the former Attorney General Peter Goldsmith struggled to find a legal justification for the war. The bigger picture is this. From the moment Bush became president, Iraq was always going to be invaded. The only decision for the UK, the closest ally to the US, was whether or not we would participate. And even had they chosen not to, British troops would have ended up in Iraq anyway, because after the invasion, they, like other major powers, would have felt obliged to go in and, with the backing of the UN, help clear up. It is also true, however, that like France and Germany, the UK could have opted out of the war. Bush gave Blair that option when it became apparent that Blair's own position was threatened. As Bush remarked at the time, he was seeking regime change in Baghdad, not London. Blair was anxious to get involved partly because, like all British prime ministers, he believed that it was in Britain's strategic interest to keep in line with the Americans. Also, one suspects it was because it gave him a role on the global stage that he would not otherwise have had, though at times it looked a little humiliating. One US newspaper dubbed him America's newest ambassador. In fairness, and contrary to what is sometimes asserted, Blair was not without influence in Washington. It was he who, together with the then U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, persuaded Bush to overrule then Vice President Dick Cheney and take the issue to the UN Security Council in hopes of a resolution explicitly authorizing an invasion in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-cooperation with weapons inspectors. For Bush and the small coterie of his father's friends who surrounded him, however, Iraq was unfinished business. Cheney and then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld were veterans of George Bush Sr.'s administrations. They regretted not overthrowing Saddam's regime when they had the chance following Saddam's eviction from Kuwait in 1991. They were the key decision-makers in Washington, and they were not going to be deflected. In his memoir, Against All Enemies, a former U.S. National Security Advisor, Richard A. Clark, describes the difficulty he and his colleagues had in persuading Bush to take seriously the threat posed by Al-Qaeda. He then describes what happened when he went into the White House the day after 9/11. Clark writes, "I expected to go back to a round of meetings examining what the next attacks could be, what our vulnerabilities were, what we could do about them in the short time. Instead, I walked into a series of discussions about Iraq. At first, I was incredulous that we were talking about something other than getting Al-Qaeda. Then I realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq," unquote. Later that day, he and some colleagues came across Bush alone in the Situation Room. "He grabbed a few of us and closed the door. Look," he told us, "I know you have a lot to do and all, but I want you as soon as you can to go back over everything. Everything. See if Saddam did this. See if he's linked in any way. I was once again taken aback. But, Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this," according to Clark's account. Bush replied, I know, but see if Saddam was involved. Just look." There was, of course, no evidence that Saddam had anything to do with 9/11, and there was no evidence that he possessed chemical weapons. Many of Blair's enemies believe that he lied. The consequences of the Iraq War are well known. Even by the terms of reference of those who planned the war, it was surely a catastrophe. Al-Qaeda, which wasn't present before the invasion, became rampant in personal terms, although this pales into comparison to the wider consequences. It is a tragedy.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
To many, poverty in England is a figment of the imagination. But with the living costs climbing up every day, just getting by is becoming more of a struggle than ever. And not just for the vulnerable.
When we go out just to do shopping for the kids, if I see like 5 years, 10 years back, £100 worth it to spend, you can buy a lot of things. But if I go today with £100 and to buy grocery for my home or kids, I mean, I cannot even fill the basket.
Announcing a phase-out of Russian oil imports earlier this month, Prime Minister Boris Johnson spoke of dark days ahead, but those days seem to be here already. Charities such as Step Change are calling on the government to increase welfare benefits and offer more help with skyrocketing energy bills. There are families who can only turn on their heating for 2 hours a day and use torches at night rather than spending on electric light. The answer from the government has left a lot to be desired. Chancellor Rishi Sunak says he cannot fully protect people from the consequences of rising prices.
There are lots of different ways he could try and play this. What he shouldn't be doing is just tinkering with, say, a little bit off the petrol or a little bit off the gas price. That won't make much difference. Focus on the weakest in society, paid for by those who are the strongest in society. Those with the broadest shoulders bear the greatest weight.
To try to curb the soaring cost of living, the Bank of England has upped interest rates. But it's a fine balance.
Landlords will soon pass on the increases. Rising interest rates affects everybody, including renters. But not everybody is affected equally. Because when you're spending every last cent on housing, food and fuel, what's there to cut when the prices keep going up?
It means more people pushed into poverty. 2.5 million people in the United Kingdom used a food bank in the past year. A former prime minister has called the crisis the worst he has ever seen.
You're going to see, I'm afraid, a significant rise in the cost of living for Britons over the next 2 years. It's not just the current level of basic items, such as the cost of fuel, the general sort of power for utilities and things like that, but also the basic cost of food. Now, that's today. The bit I worry about is actually what's going to happen in 6 months, a year's time.
It's a time of ordinary people trying to deal with extraordinary price hikes, with very little in the way of respite on the horizon. Saeed Puriza, London.
At present, the 27 nations in the European Union spend 1.5% of their economic output on weapons and troops. That is about to increase significantly because EU ministers meeting in Brussels have just adopted their strategic compass following 2 years of negotiations.
Today, the military expenditure in Europe of all member states adding up, it's about 200,000 million euros. We have to spend more.
In his press conference, Borrell highlighted that combined EU nations already spend four times more than Russia on military capabilities, but that is still not enough, he said. He insists the bloc's military plan will not undermine NATO. Many analysts say there's no doubt that it will, but that's not a bad thing, as NATO is driven by an aggressive US foreign policy, they suggest. Foreign and defence ministers are in the process of creating an EU army. They say the conflict in Ukraine proves the importance of such a move. When opinion polls are carried out, most citizens always agree they don't want more money being spent on war machines.
The more we put and focus energy on something wrong like war, you know, it increases the chance that war is coming to us.
I just think it's to make the people feel safe, but I don't really think it will change anything, so I think they should spend money on something different.
There is also resistance to the huge amounts of money being spent by the 30 countries that make up the NATO military alliance.
My party and my political friends, we want that Germany goes out of NATO. We want to bring Russia into Europe because Russia is a part of Europe and the United States are far from Europe.
NATO and EU leaders will hold summits later this week here in the Belgian capital. Peace activists are calling for greater diplomatic efforts by them to end the bloodshed in Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As the spring season begins in Kashmir, the earth turns lush green
and the trees bear colourful blossoms, with the sky visibly blue and waters clear and glassy. After a not-so-harsh winter this year, the people of Kashmir are welcoming the onset of spring. Nowruz, or the Persian New Year, marks the beginning of spring and is celebrated on March 21st. New trees are planted while people offer prayers and seek God's help for a prosperous year.
Each year we await this season so that we can plant new trees. The process of their growth gives us hope, and that hope teaches us that God has set a time for everything. We can't fast-track it. We can only do our best efforts.
On the occasion of Nowruz, women in Kashmir prepare unique dishes made from lotus stem and fish. Mehra and her sister have a busy day today. Friends and family are invited to relish the moment.
We have been taught by our mothers and grandmothers to cook these delicacies on the special occasion of Nowruz. It requires lots of dedication, and what matters is that this food brings friends and families together, and a lot of positive energy is exchanged. For us, Nowruz is not just an occasion, but it marks a fresh beginning of love, growth and prosperity.
On the occasion of Nowruz, the Kashmiri administration often organizes musical festivals to add fervor to the celebrations. People, especially children, visit these musical festivals in large numbers so that the year starts with cheerful memories. This year, scores of tourists have also come to witness Kashmir's spring.
We had heard that Kashmir looks magical, but we witnessed in reality that this land looks fabulous, especially the spring season.
The early arrival of tourists has added a lot of positivity to Kashmir's tourism sector, which has been hit hard by years of political instability and turmoil. Persian culture is deeply rooted in Kashmir, and celebrating Nowruz is a sign of its influence.
Nowruz marks a new beginning, and after suffering decades of political instability and 2 years of the COVID pandemic, people are only hoping for a return back to a normal life and an everlasting peace. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
The Iranians are celebrating it as an ancient festivity marking the first day of spring and the renewal of nature. Nowruz, a legacy from thousands of years ago, always energizes people celebrating the event to observe many customs.
Nowruz promotes values of peace and solidarity within families and across generations. It is believed to be a key contributor to cultural diversity and friendship among different communities.
Days before the arrival of Nowruz, Iranians hastily do backlogs and go shopping to embrace the turn of the Persian year, with a lot of ceremonial customs waiting to be observed. Iranians get prepared for Nowruz by cleaning their house, a custom known as Khana Tekani, dusting and cleaning home appliances and furniture, washing rugs and etc. are just parts of the house cleaning process. Moreover, the Nowruz festivity has a symbolic item unique to this tradition, Sofia Haftsin. The Haftsin spread includes 7 items, all starting with the letter Sin in the Persian alphabet. Iranians say there is a history behind each element, including serke, or vinegar, symbolizes patience and immortality, somek is a symbol of love and compassion, sib, or apple, is said to represent health and fertility, senjad, or silver berry, is seen as a simulator of love and affection, sabze, or sprout, symbolizes rebirth, sir, or garlic, is a symbol of protection in the face of affliction, and samanu represents affluence.
Iranians spend the night of Nowruz with their family. The traditional New Year dinner is fish with rice and herbs. Many families give a money gift called AD to the children to mark the New Year. People often visit each other's homes and always bring traditional gifts.
Nowruz provides a good opportunity for families and relatives to get together and visit each other. That is why Nowruz has been regarded as the feast of unification. The celebration of Nowruz needs a happy ending to make it perfect. So on the last day of this celebration, people go outdoors to celebrate the end of the Nowruz holidays. The last day of Nowruz holidays is called Sizdah Bedar, or 13 Day Out, which is also called Nature's Day.
Nowruz is a time for family and friends to gather and celebrate the end of 1 year and the beginning of the next.
Preparing for Nowruz starts a few weeks before the new year with the traditional spring cleaning of the home. At this time, it is also customary to purchase new clothing and new furniture for the home.
In 2009, the United Nations proclaimed Nowruz as an international event at the initiative of several countries that share this event, including Iran, Afghanistan, India, and Turkey. It is now widely known to be a symbol of peace to many people.
Nowruz is reminiscent of renewal and a new life. It's something beyond a mere festival. It's a culture which introduces a human civilization. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Refugees are welcome here. The most popular chant at today's protest. Thousands gathered outside the BBC over the weekend, disappointed yet again by the way Western governments are treating people fleeing war and persecution.
People here today say that the British population is being brainwashed by a racist, state-funded media. That's probably why today's protest is being held outside the BBC. They want to know why Ukrainian refugees are being welcomed, but refugees from almost anywhere else will soon be branded criminals.
The UK has issued 4,000 visas for Ukrainians with family in Britain, and anyone with a spare room is being offered £350 a month to house those without family here. They can stay for 3 years, they can work, and will have access to public services, including the National Health Service. Meanwhile, the government is pushing through the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill that could see refugees from elsewhere arriving via routes like the English Channel get up to 4 years in prison.
I feel like we're forgetting that other people are still fighting to be like considered as worthy of empathy. And we need to keep thinking about people in Palestine, in Yemen, and, you know, all the previous refugees that came to the UK, for instance, that were not treated as well, like the Syrian refugees. And for me, I think this is what today is about, to remember that we're all humans and we all deserve to be treated the same way.
Protests like these attract people campaigning for various causes, all of them somehow related to the persecution of minorities and racism.
I've been a supporter of Stand Up to Racism for many years. I grew up in apartheid South Africa and left the country because of the apartheid situation and came to England and did my education here. And I am very sympathetic to refugees. I'm appalled that we don't have, as a formerly Christian country in this country, a more open and welcoming view on refugees.
We are not against anti-Semitism. We are against the violent action of being to our kids in Gaza, and we are totally supporting Jewish people, and we are totally supporting anyone who is decent to others and peaceful to others.
Before hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian refugees mobilized, the UK insisted its public services are at breaking point. Tabloid newspapers encouraged millions to vote for Brexit in 2016, creating the illusion that Britain was being overrun by foreigners. But the media is now sending a very different message. It seems the NHS can cope, and Ukrainian refugees will not be taking any British jobs. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The United States and its key ally, the UK, launched the Iraq War in 2003 with a strike against a location where then-Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and his top commanders were believed to be meeting. But that was not an abrupt attack, as Washington and London had already begun intensifying their military build-ups in the Persian Gulf beforehand. U.S. President George W. Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair repeatedly indicated that the assault was imminent and aimed to destroy Saddam's weapons of mass destruction program. But neither UN inspectors nor intelligence services could ever find such weapons in Iraq.
None of those pretexts will really help us explain the overall project that the U.S. had in this region.
Ironically, Washington and London gave little heed to calls to allow the inspections process be given more time. Saddam, a once ally who had the full support of the U.S. and Western countries during his 8-year war against Iran, had finally grown too defiant for the U.S. to tolerate. The Iraq War, estimated to have cost the U.S. nearly $5.5 trillion and over 4,500 deaths among its servicemen. For Iraqis, the cost was much higher. More than 1 million people were killed and millions displaced, while millions more continue to face insecurity and poverty. Birth defects and cancer rates also sharply increased, as foreign forces used depleted uranium weapons in civilian areas. 19 years on since the U.S.-led invasion, the war agents are yet to be charged for any of their crimes.
War on Iraq was one of 8 wars in West Asia and North Africa, which the U.S. was carrying out in service of its plans to create a so-called New Middle East, where the entire region would be under the tutelage of the U.S. and its key allies, Israel and the Saudis.
The U.S. announced ending its combat mission in 2011, but 3 years later it started boosting deployment again, this time under the pretext of fighting Daesh terrorists. Throughout recent years, there have been multiple reports of Washington's nexus with the Takfiri terrorists, while Iraqis, with the help of the regional resistance front, were fighting themselves to eliminate Daesh.
It's now official. Russia's English-language state broadcaster, RT, stripped of its broadcasting license in the UK.
The decision was made by media regulator Ofcom that said it does not consider RT, with studios in the building behind me, fit and proper to hold a UK license, and that it cannot be satisfied that RT can be a responsible broadcaster.
To some, the move that followed weeks of rising tensions between Russia and the West over the Ukraine crisis was long overdue. To others, censorship, pure and simple. Journalist Afshin Ratansi is the host of the broadcaster's flagship program, Going Underground.
We've been in this situation together when they banned Press TV, Iran's program. I worked for Press TV. They banned that. They banned CGTN, the Chinese television company. Now they're banning RT. It just shows how much Britain is on the wrong side of history. It is the end of press freedom, the end completely, to me, it seems, like of informed consent, as in democracy. You can't have democracy without informed consent, and the British people can no longer watch programs that dissent from the prevailing narrative fed to us by the BBC and others.
The decision has also called into question Ofcom's independence. RT Deputy Editor-in-Chief Anna Belkina accused the regulator of being nothing more than a tool of the government.
I don't like censorship of any kind. I very much believe in freedom of speech. With freedom of speech comes responsibility, which is why we have Ofcom as a regulator. But if Ofcom is going to become an extension of the government peddling out that particular government style of propaganda, we are indeed entering into very dangerous territory.
As RT falls victim to unmitigated hostility towards Russia over Ukraine, media consumers here in the UK lose an important source that's brought them the other side of so many stories for so many years. Saeed Puriza, London.
The outrage was palpable at today's protest. A Freedom of Information request revealed this week that racism was a factor in the Metropolitan Police's horrific strip search of a schoolgirl known as Child Q in 2020. She was forced to bend over for two female police officers to look at her private parts. No other trusted adult was present and her parents weren't informed. The Met officers are now under investigation.
Some assert that the strip search of Child Q was an isolated incident, a crime perpetrated by a few bad apples. But members of the community disagree.
I think this feels a systematic approach that the police use. They may now regret using it in this particular instance. They may say that. How people could conceptualise strip searching a girl in school without her mum knowing about it, without an adult present, it's just heartbreaking.
Child Q has launched legal proceedings against the Metropolitan Police and her school. Many prominent figures have offered their support. The school called the police on Child Q, saying she smelt of marijuana. The strip search yielded no evidence of her being in possession of drugs.
They're out here in the streets in our schools to defend their interests. They're out here to discipline us, to create and sow and violently enforce the divisions that the ruling class needs in order to rule us and oppress us.
Now black families are torn on how to safeguard their children, to make them aware of the dangers without terrifying them of going to school.
I had to take my children out of a previous school because the black children are being treated different than the white children.